Ellen Willis, the noted feminist, cultural critic, and writer, died of lung cancer yesterday. She was 64. Willis was an influential figure in the women's movement during the late 60s and after. She was a founder of Red Stockings, a radical feminist group, and in the 80s she helped organize No More Nice Girls, a street theater and protest group focused on abortion rights. A strong advocate for women's sexual equality, she also criticized the anti-pornography current of the feminist movement as a return to conventional moralism. Willis was a music critic for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and The Village Voice, but she was best known for her essays, which appeared in The Nation, Dissent, and other publications, and which explored issues in religion, rock, politics, and sex. At the time of her death, she was a professor of journalism at New York University. Terry spoke with Ellen Willis in 1989. She and her partner, the sociologist and progressive activist Stanley Aronowitz, had started a family a few years earlier. Her daughter Nona was 4 years old at the time. Willis and Aronowitz eventually married 9 years later. Terry asked Ellen Willis how their politics affected their domestic and family life.
You and he are both cultural and political radicals, I think that's fair to say. Yes?
Yes.
And so you're really basically in agreement about, the theoretical ways in which one should go about living one's life. But when it comes down to it and you're sharing a household together and it comes time to do the dishes or vacuum the floor or decide who's going to drive your daughter to the daycare center, I don't know how much the politics really come into play because these are like hard daily decisions that have to be made. And I'm wondering if in your house you still go through the same kind of problems and quarrels and discussions that most of us have about dealing with these kinds of things.
Well, I mean, we have definitely the ideology that we should share everything. And at the same time, you're sort of dealing with a situation of scarcity where especially when Nona was younger, certainly when she was a baby, when, sort of time is so scarce that you're just both like desperate for just like a minute of rest or a minute of time for yourself. And, I think that would lead to a lot of struggles, even if it weren't for, sort of all sorts of sexist kinds of dynamics that inevitably come into play. And, I feel like, I think we both pretty much do our best in good faith to try to share everything. But then there always are things, like I really have a driving phobia. I have a driver's license, but I hate driving. And, it's sort of like definitely, I know, connected with all sorts of things about femaleness. And so Stanley does like most of the driving. I mean, virtually all the driving when we're like in the city together. And, Nona has been seeing this, and I've sort of been very bugged by the fact that she's been seeing this. And at one point she even said to me, "You have to have a penis to drive, right, Mom?"
Oh, so, I'm sure this is exactly what you wanted to hear.
and I feel like this is really on my agenda as a big thing that I have to deal with. But in the meantime, I'm sort of, she's now like seeing like a lot of other parents and a lot of other women who drive. And, I've sort of tried to make her understand that this is my weirdness and not that women can drive. And now she sort of sits in the driver's seat and she pretends that she's driving and she really wants to learn to drive. So, sort of the most important thing is that, she should get the idea that this is great, for her to try to do and,
right.
So on.
I wonder if becoming a mother has changed your priorities in terms of what you think the feminist agenda should be.
I don't think it's sort of changed my priorities so much in the intellectual sense as, it's obviously made me more aware, more practically, concretely, like immediately concerned with certain kinds of things, particularly, issues of child care and child rearing. And it's like I'm very concerned now because I feel like there's a big push for child care because there are so many women in the workforce, but that since there isn't really a strong feminist movement that's, talking about really feminist-oriented issues about child care and child rearing, I'm really afraid that, what we're going to end up with is just sort of child care that's really designed to help women do their two jobs as efficiently as possible, instead of, what we really need, which is sort of a whole reorientation of our idea of what child rearing is, and that it's not simply the mother's job, but, you know, that it's men's and, first of all, men's and women's jobs together, but also not only the parents' job, but really a public concern.
The book that you're starting to write now is on feminism, sex, and the family. And the subject makes me think about how, in really a lot of your writing, sexual freedom has been a very important issue, and that women should be able to enjoy sex as well as men, if you know what I mean. That a lot of people have defined sexual desire as more of a male than a female interest.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious about how that aspect of sexuality became so important to your kind of feminist analysis.
I think because when I was growing up, I had so much. I mean, I basically had a conservative upbringing about sex, and you know, basically, throughout my adolescence, was in like an enormous conflict about sex, and I was like very angry, you know, just sort of very angry and resentful about the double standard about sex, and about how long it took me to be able to get to the point, you know, sort of where I could really feel clear about my right to have sex and be able to enjoy sex, you know, without feeling that it was illegitimate or without feeling that men kind of had the right to judge me, you know, according to the double standard of morality. And, you know, this, you know, just made a huge impression on me. And you know, was sort of like one of the most important things that led to having a feminist consciousness. You know, the other thing was housework. Because I was very determined from an early age that, you know, I was, you know, for some reason, I, you know, thought it was very unfair that my mother did all the housework. I don't know. I got that consciousness very early, and I was like not going to do the same thing. And I was, you know, very conscious that this was a great injustice. But the other thing was sex.
Well, you came of age during the sexual revolution, quote, in the 60s. And now that a lot of people are almost afraid to have sex because of sexually transmitted diseases, I wonder if you've been rethinking at all the sexual revolution.
Well, you know, I think that there's only ever like really been the beginnings of a sexual revolution. You know, like I said in my article, you know, it's early feminists looking at the sexual revolution, we had the same reaction to it that, you know, Gandhi, when asked what did he think of Western civilization, said, "I think it would be a good idea." And, you know, we sort of felt the same way about the sexual revolution, you know, like, great idea, but it's really hardly gotten off the ground. That, you know, I think you have to have an affirmation of sex as a good thing, as a need, you know, a physical and emotional need, and as a source of ecstasy and transcendence that's, you know, an extremely important thing to the well-being of people, and that remains true no matter how risky it may be. You know, I think one has to deal with the risks. One had to deal with the risks of pregnancy. You know, one has to deal with the risks of disease, but that, you know, basically one has to affirm sex as a good thing, you know, which is something our culture hasn't yet been able to do, you know, even in spite of. I mean, I feel like we just began to do it with the sexual revolution. You know, I think a sexual revolution also entails, you know, genuinely accepting that women have equal sexual needs and equal sexual rights to men, you know, which is still not really accepted.
You co-founded a couple of the very early women's consciousness-raising groups in 1968 and 1969 in New York. And I'd be really curious what some of the main issues were at those early meetings and how that compares to what you see as the main issues now.
Well, I think the paramount issue then was just getting into public consciousness that there really was a problem called male supremacy or male, you know, male domination of women, that women were oppressed, and that our kind of main project was like analyzing and again making public like all the different ways in which women were considered as secondary human beings. I mean, a lot of things that are just sort of second nature now and kind of in the air now simply weren't. I mean, there was sort of a reflexive, taken-for-granted sexism then, you know, that sort of doesn't really exist now. I mean, people thought you were crazy if you said, well, I don't like walking down the street and being hassled by men. What do you mean? They're being appreciative. You know, what are you talking about? I don't, you know, again, things like the sexual double standard, things like men should share the housework, you know, which granted the idea is now honored more in The Breach, that, you know, then it wasn't even, you know, you were really looked on as a nut if you went to a dinner party and said, why are all the women clearing the table and the men aren't doing it? So a lot of our agenda was confronting men on these things, you know, like both on personal lives and also in on a public level, and, you know, doing the same thing with other women, you know, hey, we shouldn't be putting up with this. And this was really what consciousness raising was about.
Ellen Willis speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Willis died yesterday of lung cancer. She was 64.